The scratches of a dark night, the rashes of foresight, and I wanted you. Ooh. I get by. The matches of opportunities, the last thing I've never seen, and I scream to you. Ooh-hoo.
This is Inkstuds, CITR.ca, Inkstuds.com. This is one of my many ongoing interviews with the folks from Kramer's Ergot, Book 7. Be sure and check out the website. I've already posted interviews with Anders Nilsson and Josh Simmons, and I'll be posting, actually when this airs already, I would have posted the interview with Matt Thurber, and coming up I'll have interviews posted in the future with Ron Ricci, Frank Centuro, and of course the maestro himself, your studio mate, Mr. Sammy Harkham.
The maestro, I like the maestro.
Should we just call him that, the maestro?
Yeah. Geppetto?
Geppetto?
Yeah.
Well, that's
Geppetto? Yeah. Geppetto's the maestro in... in Pinocchio, isn't he?
He's the beard. He's the woodcutter.
Oh no. Okay, who's the maestro guy?
You're thinking in Fantasia?
No, who's the dude with the beard and tries to do all the God, what is his name? Svengali.
Ah.
Yes.
I like Svengali's a good term, but it's almost more of a musical term.
Yeah.
Well, so is maestro, I guess, actually, because that's a orchestral maestro term.
Though. We'll call Sammy the maestro.
Yeah, because Svengali makes me think of, like, Ron Perlman, the guy that organized all those boy bands. That's his Svengali, you know?
Like the string puller behind
the
curtain.
Fabricating these fake bands, and I'm really hoping that you guys aren't all just fake cartoonists, that really it's just Sammy in a closet drawing in all these different styles.
He's writing all the songs.
I'm sure he's standing right behind you. Don't say that!
I'm actually not in the studio today. I haven't been to the studio in a few days, so yeah, I haven't talked to Sammy. Did you already do your interview with him?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we talked on Monday, and it was excellent. We talked for like well over an hour, including an epic conversation of Tim Vigil.
Oh, really?
You'll have to ask him about that.
Yeah, Tim Vigil. Yeah, we've talked about him a little bit too.
Really?
It's
an odd obsession. Now, you, not only are you in Career Mr. Got 7, but you also have the collection that came out during the summer from Fantagraphics,
mm-hmm.
Sublife, and I guess that's the first book of many?
Uh-huh, hopefully.
Hopefully.
If I can survive that long, yeah.
I guess before we jump into your stuff, who are you? Who is John Pham?
Well, I'm 34 years old. I live in Los Angeles. I started doing comics, I guess, in 99 at the age of, I guess, 25, 26. I can't do the math there, but in my mid-20s. And the first comic I did was Epoxy One, which I published through the Zarek Foundation,
mm-hmm.
which I got a grant for. And I did 3 issues of that and sort of gave up on it because, I don't know, I just wasn't really... I couldn't muster up any sort of energy or enthusiasm for continuing it. Plus, I got a cease and desist from a design company with the same name.
What?
Yeah, they were called, like, Epoxy Studios or something. And I talked to a friend who was a lawyer and who gave me some counsel and said that they didn't really have a case against me,
mm-hmm.
But they were just, you know, sort of, I guess, trying to see if they could just, I guess, intimidate me into just stopping using the name. But I kind of just took it as a sign, and maybe I'm a defeatist, but I was just like, you know what, maybe this is a good time to sort of start over, because I'm not really happy with any of the stories that I'm doing, you know, in these books anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were the first comics I had ever done, so... I kind of just looked at them as a university project or something, or like a student stuff, just where you're kind of learning. And I didn't really want to, you know, work on them beyond that sort of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So I just started over, and I think it was around this time, the timing was right, because some of the people over at Fantagraphics asked me if I wanted to be part of MoM.
Yeah.
And I said, sure. And I think I did like 3 issues of MoM.
Yeah, I think on the first 3.
Yeah. And at that point, I started feeling a little unhappy, too. And I was just like, I want to do my own series, if that's possible. So I kind of, painted them into like an uncomfortable corner and demanded, you know, my own series. And luckily, they accepted.
Threw things at Gary Groth until he cried.
I basically just, you know, screamed at Gary Groth until he submitted to my iron will. But it was really good, and Sublife is sort of just the result of all that.
Now, you're saying you got started doing comics 25 and 26, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
That, for me, that seems a little unusual. For a lot of folks I talk to, it's kind of something where they don't stop. Like, it's one of those... Well, some people start at a later age, like 30 or something and kind of gave up comics, you know, and kind of resurfaced it. Yeah. But kept going through like art school or after high school. What was it for you to kind of look at this?
You mean to start at such a later
unique,
age? I guess?
Yeah.
You know, I guess I was just procrastinating up until that age. I ever since I was a kid, I wanted to do comics, and I just couldn't really figure out, you know, a sort of like venue. I mean, I could have done minis, but I didn't really feel motivated enough to do a mini.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the thing that actually really did sort of motivate me was learning about the Xeric and learning that I could, you know, actually self-publish and put together, like, you know, a book that would be offset printed. I think I did a few, I guess you could call them minis, as a kid, like in fourth grade, like a friend and I would make these little Fantastic Four comics.
Yeah.
That were tiny. I mean, they were literally minis. The staple was like half the size of the spine. They're like an inch by an inch.
Yeah.
It was my friend Florentino and me. We were way into the Fantastic Four. And those were the only comics I had ever done before Epoxy. So, yeah, for me, I guess it was just like a procrastinating thing and a lazy thing. And I mean, up until that point, all I was doing was working these like shitty. Oh, can I say? Can I cuss?
Yeah, well, it's just gonna be on the internet, so.
Oh, okay. I was just working these shitty jobs and going to school. So I just didn't really. I guess I talked myself out of doing comics because I guess I didn't have the time or something.
Mm-hmm. So what were a lot of comics that really, other than Fantastic Four, that really got you jived on them? And which Fantastic Four run was it that really...
It was the Byrne run.
Okay.
Like in the 80s.
Oh, yeah. The good ones.
Yeah, it was the Byrne run. I think the year was 84. That really got me into, like... Before then, I was reading, I guess, some kids' comics. There was this line that Marvel put out in the 80s called Star.
Oh, yeah. With, like, Harvey and... not Harvey.
Planetary.
Heathcliff.
Heathcliff, I think, was in the line.
Yeah.
Strawberry Shortcake, The Get Along Gang. And I remember buying some of those. And
Muppet,
you know,
Babies.
The Muppet Babies, too. And I think those were some of the first comics I had bought, but I didn't really get... You know, into them as much as I did the Byrne run of the Fantastic Four, so that was sort of like my gateway drug into the rest of the like superhero stuff that Marvel was putting out at that time. And so I collected superhero stuff all through, I guess my childhood up until I think my sophomore year in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the Atlantis attacks, crossover. Yeah, thing that finally turned me off.
It and broke like, you.
It broke me. I mean, I just couldn't. Yeah, I couldn't rationalize or justify like buying all those related books. You know, books that were related to that event anymore. And I just was getting sick of the storylines and stuff. And
does anyone really care about Namor? Honestly.
Namor, the half-breed.
The Submariner.
No. I mean, I think the most people would care is whether, you know, you pronounce the name Submariner or Submariner. I think Marvel tried to, yeah.
I'm Canadian. That's how we pronounce it.
Yeah. Submariner is the Canadian pronunciation, I guess?
Let's say it is, yeah.
Okay.
Because we got the Maritimes and stuff like that.
So it was in I think my junior year, there was a comic book store next to my high school. And in one of their like 50 cent bins, I found an issue of Weirdo. And Weirdo was sort of, yeah, Weirdo, it was issue number, it might have been issue number 18. It's the one with the cover of this guy who's being made fun of for looking like Larry from the Three Stooges.
Oh, the Drew Friedman cover.
No, it's a Chrome cover.
Oh, is it? Okay.
And it's like these two like LA jogging or like these two LA joggers.
Oh, and it's kind of yellow and red.
It's more. There's a lot of white.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll find the issue number and I'll email it to you.
I've got them all at home.
Okay. Yeah, but Weirdo was like a revelation for me in high school. You know, it was like perfect for me at that tender age, and sort of got me started on, I guess, like trying to seek out and like discover comics that were like that, and through that I started reading 8-Ball, you know, and it just like a bunch of other stuff, and you know, Love and Rockets and
the classics.
Yeah, the classics for that, I guess, that era.
So that influenced you on what you wanted to do with Sublife, I guess, as far as that kind of bunch of different stories within the story, within the book. Because, I mean, those are all, I mean, Weirdo, I mean, it's an anthology of madness at that point. I think that was when Pete Bagg was doing it.
Yeah, I think around that issue, Bagg had taken over, like, the guest editor duties.
Yeah.
But, Yeah. An anthology. I've always dug, especially like the one creator anthologies, like even those early issues of like Optic Nerve, where Tomine was doing, you know, like three or four different stories per issue, mm-hmm. really short ones, you know. But especially like 8-Ball, and then you know the Acme Novelty Library, where it was like maybe some shorter strips alongside. You know, like a serialized, longer sort of story. Those, for some reason, really, I guess, like, resonated with me.
Well, that's some of my favorite stuff, is where he just goes right off to the, in one direction, and just plays around, and,
yeah,
you know. So, with Sublife, tell me about one of the characters in there. I just gotta say this. It reminds me of like what a Mark Bell character would look like in real life. Almost.
Would it be Rush?
The one guy with has like carrying like a bag over his whole body.
Oh, Terrence. Yeah.
Yes.
Wait, what was the question? You want me to tell you about him?
Well, no. Tell us a little bit about Sublife, but I just wanted to make that observation. It felt like one of those. Yeah, in a complimentary way, it's like...
Oh, no, yeah, no, that's a high compliment. I love, yeah. I think that character actually might have been a... For some reason, I just had this... I kept on doodling in my sketchbook that character, and I think it might have come from, like, a Charlie Brown, like a Peanuts, like one of their Halloween...
Oh, okay.
Like, I guess, you know, episodes where Charlie Brown's... I mean, his costume is the sheet over his head, the ghost.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kept on doodling it, and for some reason he just made it into the story, and I just like the idea of like doing a narrative, like a long sort of narrative, like comic story, with some characters that could only exist in, you know, in like a comics medium. Like you can really represent Terrence in like a movie, a character like Terrence in a movie or in a novel.
Yeah, because it would be novel. The movie would look too. You couldn't make this odd, conceptual cartoony guy in a novel. It'd be like Terrence was walking around with a bag over his body, covering down to his midway between his waist and his knees. It's like
it would just be and for some reason in comics it may seem ridiculous, but it you know. I guess it sort of fits, and it doesn't take you out of the story too much. But I started to encounter some problems. Like, he didn't have any arms. So, I couldn't have him do, you know, like, semi-normal stuff, like walk around with a backpack on or type at a computer.
Yeah.
So in the story, there's a part where it sort of, like, fast-forwards a few years. And I have Terrence graduate from, like, the knee length sheet to just a sheet covering his head.
Yeah, I saw that. I thought that was his summer do, maybe.
Summer in LA.
Yeah.
It's him, and he's grown taller too. I think in the beginning of the book, he's like, you know, maybe like a freshman in high school, and then towards the end of that first issue, he's like a junior or something, and he's had his growth spurt.
Now, do all the stories kind of intertwine with each other that are in here? Because the one part with the redneck uncle and nephew and...
Yeah.
It seems separate, but it seems like it goes together with the other stuff as well.
Yeah, it will. I mean, as the story sort of you know, goes along, it'll be more apparent how they relate. They won't necessarily, you know, all end up eating together in the same like banquet hall or something, or like intertwining like that movie Crash,
yeah,
or anything like that. I mean, I didn't want it to be, you know, like the climax of the novel will be when they finally all meet. It's just gonna they'll sort of relate to each other, I guess, thematically, and then they'll maybe some of the characters will encounter, you know, some of the other ones. And
so we're not gonna have any kind of cosmic battle at the end.
No. I mean, not like Secret Wars. Not like that. Where they all go up against Terrence, or Terrence is like this Bengali. And
Terrence
like
will come out with a black bag.
Oh, yeah. Or he'll end up... I was listening to the Jonathan Bennett interview that you guys did, and the Hasselhoff Beyonder connection was something I'd never even considered.
Oh, that's... I forgot what we talked about.
You guys were talking about Secret Wars 2, and Bennett made the... he thought that the Beyonder in Secret Wars 2 looked like David Hasselhoff from Knight Rider.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Well, to me as a kid, I always thought he looked like... I thought they were going for Michael Jackson, like Jerry Curl thing.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. Anyway, getting back to...
But I digress.
But I digress, yeah. It's... they're definitely... I mean, I don't want to... there's a lot of it I still haven't figured out for myself yet, but, yeah, it won't be a... all the stories will sort of relate to each other in a way that I hope will be satisfying without necessarily being, you know, like, obvious.
Yeah. Now, is the plan to continue being filled mainly with that, or are you going to start introducing other stories or other pieces of work? Because there is the bookends of the alien or the space story.
Yeah, definitely there's going to be... The first issue was kind of constrained by a number of things, I wanted to do a 72-page comic at first.
Yeah.
But it ended up getting trimmed down to 64, and I had to basically gather all the stuff that was in MOM and put that in there. So that was one constraint, and then I had to kind of like end the Sycamore Street thing kind of in a satisfying way, so it's not such a weird, abrupt ending.
Mm-hmm.
So to do that, it ended up, the actual, you know, Sycamore thing ended up filling most of those 64 pages. And all I had left over were the inside covers. So I originally wanted the first issue to have, like, you know, five or six different strips going on, like some one-pagers and stuff. But, you know, because of the page count, I wasn't able to do that. So in issue two, it'll be there'll be much more variety and much more different stuff going on, including the deep space strip, which is, you know, the astronaut strip that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm interested to see where that goes. So
yeah, that one's gonna be really hopefully, you know, fun for a lot of other people to read, because I'm really excited about it. I really want to turn that into just like a straightforward like adventure strip, with like some sci-fi, like soft sci-fi stuff in there.
Tell one thing I noticed, especially with that strip, is you like to throw in, I guess, like awkward moments.
Yeah. There's a, I guess the one awkward moment is it's because it's these astronauts who are getting cabin fever and who are basically lost in space.
Is it kind of like that old Ren and Stimpy space madness?
I haven't seen that. I'll take you for your word. Yeah, probably like that. So the captain is, you know, he's slowly just sort of losing his mind, and it makes for some interesting situational stuff.
Awkward.
But there'll be less of that as it goes on, because finding that alien guy sort of, breaks the spell for them.
It gets it going.
It gets them going, gives them hope.
Now, tell me about your strip in the Kramer's, soon to be used as a table, book 7.
The strip is it relates actually to some of the characters in the Sycamore Street.
Oh, okay.
Strip. It's got if you look at the first few pages of the Sycamore Street, it's about a pack of stray dogs, kind of like walking around or wandering through LA and then chasing a cat. So the strip in Kramer's is about that group of dogs. Specifically, well, in Sublife it's three dogs, but in Kramer's it's only two of the stray dogs. And the story in Kramer's is, I guess, a really simple one. It's just these two dogs wandering through some parts of L.A. In the beginning, it's MacArthur Park, which is this park built around like this man-made lake, kind of near downtown L.A. here. And the dogs wander through there, and then they wander along the freeways. Something happens to one of the dogs on the freeway, and then they find like a sort of like a resting place for the end of the day by the end of the strip, and it sort of loops around from there. It's a silent strip too. There's no dialogue, obviously, because it's just these dogs. And it's a one pager.
And you're taking full advantage of the magnitude of the page?
I'm trying to. I did some, I tried to do some stuff with the size of it. I drew like this giant lamp post on the left side of the entire page. And the way the page is laid out is like there's this, it's hard to explain, but like the actual page itself is like one giant panel. And that panel, contains the lamppost and the two dogs. But within the larger page panel are these three sort of separate sequences of smaller panels.
It's kind of like what Frank King would do with like having one structure and the characters moving throughout it on his Sunday pages.
Kinda.
Not that you're,
It's hard. It's really hard to describe. You know what? The people who are listening are just going to have to go out and buy it.
I think so. Kramer's Ergot 7, Buenaventura Press. And you're going to be one of the fellows on all the tour stops, I understand. Am I right?
Most of them, yeah. I'm going to be on all of them except for the Chicago one. I'm going to diverge from the tour on the second to the... Right before the Chicago one, I'm going to make a detour and go into upstate New York and visit my brother.
Because
I think Toronto is the second to the last stop, and Toronto is only like two hours away from where my brother lives. So I'm just gonna have him pick me up and hang out with him.
Because I don't
get much of a chance to hang out with him.
Take advantage.
Yeah, but yeah, the tour is gonna be interesting.
It looks insane.
Yeah,
it's a lot of folks.
A lot of people.
Now, how does living in L.A. affect your cartooning? Because it seems to be pretty central for your storytelling.
L.A., I guess for a lot of the obviously L.A.-based stories is a huge part. In Sycamore Street is basically going to be about Los Angeles in a way. And then, like, the cover of the first issue is sort of like this weird... rendering of L.A., like this really simplified, like smashed together or smooshed together sort of drawing of Los Angeles. I've grown up here most of my life, and there's a lot of really, weird things about L.A. There's a lot of really great things about it. It's one of the cities that inspires like a lot of weird... like love, but also, some level of resentment and complaint.
Mm-hmm.
People love complaining about L.A. In a way that's not like, New Yorkers. Like New York, I mean, living in New York is hard, but there's this weird sort of camaraderie and like pride about living in a city like that, that you don't really get in L.A. You know, L.A. is there's a different kind of toughness or, like, difficulty in living in Los Angeles that doesn't really inspire that kind of pride or camaraderie a lot of times. It inspires more, like, whining and complaining about driving and, you know, stuff like that. All the actors and entertainment industry folks.
The L.A. madness.
Yeah, but, you know, it's my home. I accept it.
So, as far as people want to check out your stuff, mainly it's in the Sublife from Fantagraphics, and the most recent Kramers. Anything else people can track down?
No, for now that's pretty much it. I try to keep all my, you know, all my comics work centralized in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that's why I really wanted to do like a one person anthology, because I knew if I continued, and I loved, you know, working on Moam, and I really like a lot of the work that's in Moam, but it just for me, I have this like weird OCD thing where everything just has to kind of be in one place. I can't, you know. So doing the Kramer's thing was like the one exception that I made.
Well, I have to say, as a reader, I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's tough having to, you know, track down all your favorite creators' like work that's been sprayed over all these anthologies.
Yeah, nothing like tracking down a Zadie Smith anthology to get the Daniel Klaus and Chris Ware strip. It's like, I just want that stuff. I don't care about this regular book.
No, that was a good story. I guess he, you know, will make the exception for that and for the Kramer's anthology too. But otherwise, or the, you know, the occasional like New Yorker cover. But,
New Yorker.
Yeah.
Well, when can we expect to see the next Sublife?
It looks like it's on the docket now for next year, I think around middle of the year.
Oh, okay.
I wanted it to come out sooner, but you know, I got stuck doing this one like day job thing for like 4 or 5 months here. So that totally screwed up the publishing schedule for Sublife, but the plan generally is to try to do about two issues a year.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you.
That's John Pham, and his book is Sublife from Fantagraphics, as well as the new Kramer's Urgot Book 7. Check it out, folks.
Okay, ready? Be with you all through the night. This precious time, when time is new, all through the night to die. Knowing that we feel the sun without saying. Forward all through the night, and once we start, the meter clicks, and it goes running all through the night until it ends. There is no end. All through the night, stray cat is crying, so stray cat sings back all through the night. They have forgotten what by day they laugh. Keep with me forward all through the night.